the only other topic, but that's in the next newsletter, is essentially we can talk a little bit perhaps about threats. I can't use it because it's like the EU, and I mean, I told people it should tell you something that
Threads didn't start
in the EU.
Yes. I got Threads.
Yeah, like everyone except.
Yeah, I mean, teams. I got it because I was like, I would be irresponsible probably not to just look at it.
Yes, I wanted some too.
When I opened it, I just had this like feeling like, wow, just another stream of I was just like, oh, please.
Yes.
Welcome to the CTO podcast. A show dedicated to all the brave humans showing up in technology leadership roles around the globe. Every week, we'll help you keep track of the stories you missed, the trends that might pass you by, and talk to people that shape how we should show up as chief technology officers. I am your host, Etienne De Bruin, founder of 7CTOs, and joining me as always is the creator of Amazing CTO Newsletter, Stefan Schmidt. Let's go.
Yeah, like I joined Twitter in, I think, 2008 or something, so it's 15 years. Like, I don't know, but today I had the feeling like I also migrated partially to Mastodon, did a little bit there, not taking off. I literally have the feeling like this kind of communication is done. You know, it's I don't know. I mean, I have quite some followers. I interact with people on Twitter and stuff like that. You interacted today with the chair, you know, so there is something happening. But I just had today, I thought about this with the announcement of Threads. I just had the feeling that a lot of people had enough. It moved on. It's like, okay, Twitter was a thing, but it might not be longer. So yes, everyone is rushing through Threads. Like, they had 10 million in 5 hours or something, 10 million signups in 5 hours or something. But today I had the feeling like this topic, like, moved on. You know, I don't know.
The thing that, just, I mean, watching Zuckerberg tweet or not tweet, announce Threads. 5 million signups, 10 yes. million signups. I thought to myself, sure, okay, you know, obviously you're going to have millions of signups. Are people excited about it? Now there's an interesting thought I have about Threads. First of all, it's an Instagram product. So I find it very interesting that they're saying it's Threads by Instagram. You have obviously not gone through the sign up process, and I'll just say the sign up process makes it very clear that this is an Instagram product. So I'm going to say, this might be an unpopular opinion, I think that's kind of an interesting move, because because I see some, the press is complaining, the press is complaining that the app lacks any sort of innovation or a magic feature. And part of me is thinking, you know what? I think that it's right in front of us. It's really a feature that was added to Instagram. It's a separate app, I get it. But I'm wondering where things are moving towards with, or what the Meta's plan is with this, is really some sort of Trojan horse, and I think in an innovative way, to upgrade the Instagram platform. Because, you know, Instagram is photos and videos. And I'm wondering, by the name choice, you know, Threads is an odd name for me. It's kind of a dumb name, in my opinion, because Threads is not an easy thing to say or understand. And also, it sounds a lot like threats.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and how do you say that you tweeted something? Like, I threaded something? Or like what are you going to say? What is the verb of threads?
Yeah.
But maybe there'll be a fun name that comes out of that. But anyways, I find it really interesting that it's an Instagram product, and that potentially maybe, and I don't know how dumb this is, but maybe a year or two or three from now, maybe a merging of Instagram and Threads as now the new product.
I read today, which is a little bit going in the same direction, but different. Someone wrote, what problem are they solving? And, you know, and I got thinking because that got me thinking because with the demise of Twitter, it looks like a no-brainer to create a competitor, like Blue Sky, like that. It looks like a no-brainer to create that. And so that doesn't need to be a reason because it's obvious, kind of. And then on top of it, it's someone large, like someone who has a staying power, who can shift people there. So I think it looks like a no-brainer that Facebook, Meta, like, I don't know, they do it. But then someone asked, what problem are they solving? And then I think that ties into two ways. It ties into what I said before, that I might think that Twitter is something of the past. This kind of communication might, or this kind of distribution might be a thing of the past. And on the other hand, the hidden problem they are solving might be Instagram. So this is going into that. That would be something that ties in what you said.
Yeah, I'm scrolling through Threads as you're talking, and you know it's just crazy how I look at this and I'm like, how did this? It's like this app is a million years old already. Like thousands of people.
Yeah,
people that I
that's
follow
astonishing.
On. People that I follow on Twitter or Instagram, it's like they've been threading for years. It's just like,
yeah,
it's just, you know, I think for the marketers and anybody that is hacking the growth of their companies, it's boom, Meta just gave them a brand new channel, right?
Yes.
And so I think they're solving not maybe a particular, I don't think they're solving maybe an end user problem. I think they're just going to just where the audience is at and where there's a new audience. And, you know, Meta is the largest, most impactful social media company on the planet.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like I think about Apple's a few years ago, I saw that Apple's cable business is larger than most corporations, right? I we should look at the numbers, but the cabling business of Apple is profoundly larger than the $1 billion of revenues.
Yeah.
And the same for me with Meta, which is, you know, another massive company who can just insert a product into the market space and instantly have a massive user adoption. I mean, if you told me, hey, build an app and, you know, within a day, you're going to have 10 million users. I'm like, I would consider that massive success.
To me, it's more, even more astonishing what you said, that you open Threads and it feels like an app that's 10 years there, you know, or something. That this instant aging, or not aging, that aging sounds too negative, but this instant, that's astonishing. My prediction would be like the age of Twitter apps is over, but we'll see.
Ironically, in the last few months, I've found Twitter to become more and more important to me. Only because, and I had a thought the other day where I was like, wow, these other people that I used to follow really are not tweeting anymore, so they're all over on Mastodon. I need to take a look at what's going on in the Fediverse. By the way, Threads, one of the things Threads says is that they will be integrating with the Fediverse in the coming months.
Okay. Interesting choice.
So basically, that's fascinating that Threads will potentially become the... What a fascinating coup if they create this gorgeous Mastodon client.
Yes.
But it's Facebook, you know. It's like, you know, the human is the product. No data is safe. Company, integrates with the Fediverse, which is your data belongs to you and we're not going to do anything with your data. And there's no real company behind this. They really get you.
I moved off Facebook a long time ago. It's paused, so I keep the URL because it's like a common name in Germany and I have that URL to have for that name. So I haven't deleted my account for the URL. But yes, I got off. So now I might be... They tried to pull me in with my Oculus Rift, you know, when they migrated all the Oculus stuff. I resisted. I still resist. I think next time I turn on my Oculus, I need to go for a Meta account. But like I resist. But then, you know.
Yeah, I think my skeptical CTO brain says, screw this sucks. Why, like, the top FAANG companies continue to like fight these wars at the very top echelon of the stock market. And so I have, with my CTO mind, I have a skepticism about this. It's just another feeble attempt to grab people and their data, and I want to resist that. But as a entrepreneur who wants to reach more people and wants to make a greater impact, I mean, why wouldn't I celebrate the arrival of TikTok, celebrate the arrival of Threads, celebrate whatever?
Same here. I will have a Threads account as soon as that's possible. Like, I check on my phone, but then it's not possible to get it, you know? So
4 hours ago, Zuck threaded that there have been 30 million signups as of this morning. Feels like the beginning of something special, but we've got a lot of work ahead to build out the app. And then Mr. Beast, I feel like I'm cheating on Twitter by using this app. But then you see Shaquille O'Neal joining, Netflix, Gary V, boom, right there, man. Just like, he threaded this thing and then he says, and then there's 3,600 replies, 17,000 likes. AOC, she's a popular politician in the United States. She's like, all right, let's do this thing. May this platform have good vibes, strong community, excellent humor, and less harassment. 2,200 replies and 50,000 likes. I mean, I think anybody who says this was a dumb move or why did they do this? I mean, they should. This is like Startups 101. I mean, you have a built-in audience and you just gently insert an app into the stream. And what's the worst thing that can happen? I mean, the app can fail and they don't do it. I mean, I don't know. It seems like a no-brainer for me.
At least you had more users than the multiverse, I think. So
what
was it, multiverse? I don't know. Was it like
the metaverse?
Metaverse.
Yes.
So Fediverse, Metaverse, Multiverse, I you see me confused, you know.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see when the first you know, content moderation issues come up, you know, when someone starts complaining, oh, my tweet, my post on Thread was taken down, or the first sort of hate speech that starts coming up. It'll be really interesting to see.
I think the first milestone for me would be if the traditional media cites Threads instead of tweets, you know, like now we see tweets everywhere in films and like in the media and everywhere someone quotes a tweet. And if this stops, like there's some, it's just like, I work for eBay, you know. And it's a little bit like with eBay, where just everyone in films, in Hollywood, someone buying or selling some stuff, or something, it was eBay, you know. They're looking for some strange things. It was on eBay. And there was so much free advertising and free brand building. And I think the same happened for the last 15 years with Twitter, with like tweets, a product embedded in nearly all media, you know? And when I think with this switches, that would be interesting when this happens. And then more breaking point would be the tipping point. Also breaking point would be then if there are more people, media quotes more threads than tweets, you know. Then
and maybe just another distinction here is that Meta is a publicly traded company accountable to its shareholders. Of course, Elon
to its shareholder.
Elon took Twitter private. So from a ideology, you know, where are you contributing your thoughts to a dictator who can do anything he wants or to someone who needs to consider the market? And I think that there are pros and cons in both areas.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Fascinating topic. Maybe we can be friends on Threads.
You know, wouldn't need to move to the US.
Okay. I want to talk to you about a network I founded over 10 years ago when I felt like I wasn't getting the support I needed from other CTOs. I was concerned that I wasn't getting a soundboard. My ideas were amazing to me, but I was concerned that maybe they were biased towards my own experiences. And really, as my whole company looked to me to build out their technology organization, I felt a little concerned that was I getting the education I needed? Was I getting the pushback that I needed? And I wasn't getting that from my fellow C-suites because they were not technical. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to jump in and create a network where we all have to come with our authentic selves and share our insecurities, our challenges, and honestly just face the next level of scale. We all know that what used to work 6 months ago isn't necessarily going to work 6 months from now as we are constantly growing our organization. So 7CTOs is a peer network of hundreds of CTOs who get together once a month in groups of 6 or 7 to learn something new together, to process some challenges together, and then really to just encourage each other on this journey. We assemble people at the same levels. We use a proprietary framework called CTO Levels to make sure that people are actually peers. And my goal is to have those 4 or 5 hours you spend with that group every month be the most valuable time-saving hours that you can spend. Don't go down the rabbit holes. Don't wallow in insecurity. Don't be angry for too long. But come and get that support that you need. It is a lonely place sometimes. It is a high-stress environment. So 7CTOs is literally the tech people, the geeks, the nerds who are all also taking on the growing of companies. We do our forum meetings. We do our deep dive calls. We do our retreats. We do our conferences. So really just your people. Come and check it out. Head over to 7ctos.com, hit the apply button, and we'll get you into a forum within 30 days. That is our guarantee. Love to see you there. See you soon.
Okay. The topic is stability AI CEO. There will be no human programmers in 5 years.
Wow. Imad Mostaku, founder and CEO of Stability AI, has a provocative prediction as artificial intelligence increasingly transforms our world. He said there will be no programmers in 5 years. He seems to envision a near future shaped by the capabilities of AI. So this was an interview he did, and interesting, he says, the article says that data from GitHub reveals that 41% of all code right now is AI generated. So, of course, Stability AI is the company behind Stable Diffusion. But he does say something very interesting, which I talk about quite a bit also, is this idea that the ChatGPT or some of these language models will run on your phone in its completeness.
Yeah.
And the impact that that's going to have with fully resident AI models on our phones. And I joke with my kids because I tell my kids and my parents, we all live together in San Diego. I tell them there's going to be a time in 2 or 3 years, I think we're all going to mock how dumb these phones are. And we're going to say, remember when you had to type things out on a touch screen and how stupid that was? And you had a little keyboard that you had to like type things on and you couldn't ask the phone to do anything. Like, it's unbelievable that if you consider the iPhone's release in, was it 09 or was it 07? And a quick 15 years later, or within 15 years, I mean, if you consider the innovation has mostly been on the camera, and the camera has been incredible, but next step, absolutely, this phone's screen, I think, needs to become this phone has to be a lot thinner, and mostly just the screen should be used for consumption or something, but the rest has to be audio conversations with this thing.
I was thinking about this before this ChatGPT explosion. And I thought, when everyone started to put AI chips into the phones, and I thought, well, that's, I don't know, what's like, just for a better camera experience and stuff like that. I wasn't so convinced. I mean, I understood that that was necessary somehow, but I thought it was too early. I was like, processor power might increase and thing. But then this happened. Then ChatGPT happened. The ChatGPT explosion happened. And it got clear that you need a much better and faster inference power. You need to generate more tokens per second than you can generate on a CPU. And that's kind of the new metric is, I think, tokens generated per second. And so it made totally sense that everyone puts inference chips into that can run models, local models into their phones. And I would totally agree. And I think the irony of the, all of this is that the innovation of the iPhone, I don't have one. I had the first one, the first and the second one. I had the first iPod and the first iPod Nano and the first Power Mac. I don't have any Apple, I think, anymore. But no, there's one on the, an iMac Pro on the shelf. So, but I had it all. Really, Xserver, a lot of products no one knew. But the innovation of the iPhone is getting rid of the keyboard, you know?
Doing away with the keyboard
is like, that's what I think is the kind of the innovation. The internet phones, I had a touch, a pen phone, an Ericsson phone, 900 something, very, very bad phone. Very bad apps. I had a BlackBerry, and I had before that I had a Palm, and one of the Palms with a keyboard. And it was like kind of feeling that to use a phone with as a messenger, writing primarily emails, you need a keyboard, a hardware keyboard. And just today I saw a small video clip from Steve Ballmer who laughed at the iPhone because it has no keyboard. He says, this will never take off in the office because it has no keyboard, so you can't write emails. You know, so the innovation of the iPhone kind of is making it usable, writing a lot of stuff with no keyboard, you know, and no pen. I think the pen point was that Steve Jobs made, but essentially it's no keyboard, no pen. And now you're saying 50 years later, we laugh at typing stuff and just, you know, so the thing that made it great, the iPhone is going away and it's irrelevant. It's becoming irrelevant.
We have a device that, honestly, this device, as amazing as it is pretty dumb. Really, it's a dumb device. It basically took a computer and put it on a touch screen and we can carry it in our pockets. And it connects to GSM networks and we can talk to each other. I mean, really, There is nothing remarkable about this other than that. I mean, yes, it shrunk the laptop to the size of a phone. And
yes.
And the genius of the genius of saying that it's the smartphone that's going to evolve and not the laptop that's going to shrink.
Yeah.
Was a genius. Like, I don't know if Steve Jobs did that, but you know, with his agreement with AT&T, I know BlackBerry, their innovation was that they were piggyback off of the part of the spectrum that was unused, so they could sort of always be connected, but they didn't have to sign. I think they had an agreement with, was it Verizon? But the fact that the smartphone was the cell phone to the smartphone, which then surpassed what most of us had on our desktops in the 90s, and what, you know, eventually the computing power outweighing what went to the moon, basically. It is still an unremarkable thing. I mean, it's you know, doom scrolling is basically, my kids are, you know, yes, there's some content creation and there's some TikTok videos, but I think it has reached its evolutionary maximum. And now I think the next move, man, absolutely is 50% of the hardware on this thing is not going to be necessary anymore. It's all going to be dedicated to these embedded AI models.
Yeah.
And it's going to be mind-blowing. It's going to be like, I can't believe I can tell this piece of junk to plan my trip to Hawaii and just make it happen, and boom, it happens. You know, that to me, that's what's coming. You know, and so then what does that mean for apps? You know, I talk to people about apps. Why? I mean, yes, applications on this phone makes sense. Applications on a AI phone is not going to make any sense. I'm not going to want to go find the app, click the app. Yeah, why am I going to open an app to tell the... I know what I want. I don't want to go and translate that into touching a touch screen and an app.
I'm a strong believer of convenience. I think the most of the innovations we made and the progress we made, some people debate we made progress as humanity, but let's assume we did make progress as a human race, is based on convenience. It's also something that I think EV adoption will drive, because people understand that it's much more convenient to have an EV than a gas-driven car. But and I think so app, you have an AI that can do stuff, and you have an app where you need to click and open. It's just inconvenient, and if you have two things, one convenient and one inconvenient, the inconvenient thing will die. I think that's how progress works.
Stefan, just something that blows my mind. When I got my Apple Watch, let me just hang with me for 2 minutes. When I saw the iPhone for the first time in an Apple store in Fashion Valley Mall in San Diego, I couldn't believe how it felt when I touched the phone. Like, I had an emotional response to the fact that the machine was so responsive to my touch.
Yeah.
And of course, I wanted the Wi-Fi features, and a lot of the features I wanted up until that moment was nowhere to be found, and the iPhone just had it, and it was great.
Yeah.
My moment with my Apple Watch was the most unexpected thing, and that was the fact that I could tell my watch to remind me of something. So the watch is on my wrist, and I just tell it, hey, remind me to tell my wife about what happened with the kids today, or something like that. And the fact that you can take the call is actually kind of freaky amazing. It's again, the watch was released many years ago. But my point is, what does it do to the Apple Watch or to the watch, and what does it do to the phone when you start talking about embedded AI models? Like if I could have an embedded AI model on my watch.
Yeah. Yes.
And I have an embedded AI model on my phone. Does it...
Don't use the phone.
Do we start moving to a place where this phone becomes a relic and yes. really the attention has moved to our watches?
Where the camera saves it.
Well, I don't know about the camera. Yes, the camera is a... I actually think it's a great time for a startup to create dedicated camera devices.
But then again, yes. I'm sounding like Stefan, you know.
Yes, yes.
The assumption is, do people use the camera on their phone because they have the phone to read email and do stuff? And, well, they have the camera with them. And then they create images. But we have seen so saturated with images. Is it like if we have an AI assistant in a watch, like then do we really want to take that many images? You know, is it like, do we take that many images because we want to take that many images? That would be one hypothesis, or because we have a phone with us that can create that can make photos. So what's the driver there? And if the driver is just we make images because, well, I have a camera and let's make an image, then perhaps again that would be the time to buy Canon.
Yes,
and
yes,
Nikon shares.
Yes. So are we moving to a world then where the phone will become less important? The watch becomes a lot more important.
Yep.
And we have a new category of startups that are now designing, going back to a dedicated, amazing camera. Okay, it's internet enabled and whatever. It's on LTE. Who cares? But we are moving away from this idea that your eyes need to be on a screen and I can get most of my tasks done just by talking to my phone.
Yeah. And Sony is rumored to next generation 2024 cameras will have Android and apps, AI apps and stuff and manipulation apps. So it's rumored that Sony will move there on the one hand. I'm currently looking for another, I look for a watch now, and not that I want to buy a Rolex, but that would be interesting to what are people doing that currently wear a Rolex, you know, like, okay, I have a phone and a Rolex, so now what are I doing now? Do I have a Rolex on this arm and an Apple Watch on this for the AI, or is the AI getting into the Rolex, or what, like, I don't know what's happening there.
Well,
because currently it's just working fine with the phone and an expensive watch, but I can not use an Apple Watch if I don't.
Yes.
Want to.
Now, but and this is if I was to look at Apple's strategy with the Vision Pro, is it possible that they see that the phone is sort of declining as a innovative device, and now it's the goggles? And let's take, you know, iPhone 1 was a big clunky little phone and it didn't do much. What does the Vision Pro or the Vision line look like in 10 years? Maybe it'll be
just
super thin, incredible, like what?
Just a Ray-Ban.
Yeah.
In 10 years.
So now you have, and remember they have the AirPods. So why can't the future Vision Pro be very thin glasses, wear my AirPods, and somehow my watch technology becomes some sort of driver?
Yes.
And maybe the battery technology is embedded somewhere else. I don't know. But
if that is the case, I will take everything back I ever said about Tim Cook. You know, we see that the future of the phone is the phone is doomed. So let's do something. A long shot for something different, then I will take back and everything I said about Tim Cook. You know, so that's never said anything bad about Tim Cook.
Tim Cook, if you're listening, Stefan said that you know, he's ready for some innovation from you.
I will buy Apple again, you know, after I bought everything from Apple when Steve Jobs was there. And a Newton, you know, how many people had a Newton? I had a Newton. So, you know, Tim, I buy Apple again and I will take back everything I said. But about one sentence about the five years, do you think it's realistic that development will go away? And if you think it's realistic that development will go away, what would be your time frame?
Yeah, it's a really interesting, you know, reading the article, I feel like it's one of those provocative statements.
Yes.
Where, you know, depends on how you define there. It depends on how you define will. It depends on how you define be. It depends on how you define no. It depends on how you define programmers. Yes. Depends on how you define 5 years. But no, I mean, I think it's going to have a radical shift. And I was driving, you know, I was driving home with my son from a tennis camp. He's 14. And my thoughts sort of wandered, and I was thinking, wow, I really don't know if my son should be learning programming. And I know the answer is yes, just, you know, learn and keep going. I mean, it's, you know, learning the fundamentals of programming. And he does some C#. He does some C# and, you know, he messes around with Unity and all that. But it is a very strange time to be thinking about programming careers when I know when you and I were kids and we loved programming and games and, you know, it was an obvious choice for me. Okay, you know, obviously I'm going to become a software developer and we're going to code and we're going to have fun and we're going to build amazing things. And so for me, the question becomes, if programmers are builders, what does the building look like in 5 years? Programming, I think it's interesting that he said programming. Yes, I mean, I think programming died when people started copying and pasting code snippets from Stack Overflow, right?
Yeah, might be. Yeah.
So I wonder what is building going to look like with AI? Because if everybody has been upgraded because 41% of all code on GitHub is generated, I think that's it's incredibly beautiful. It's something to be celebrated. But the question for me is just what does building look like?
Yeah. Coming back to the question, for your definition of a programmer and programming and creation, when will the current model be done? So he said 5 years. What would be your
I find it very hard to think it's ever going to be done.
I can't get an answer, it seems.
I don't know. What do you think?
So that if this would be an interview, I would be like, I would not let you get out of that one. You know, people try to get out of a question, they're not answering. But because this is not an interview, obviously, and I will let you get out. I think the 5 year came something like, okay, if I say 10 years, that's not provocative enough. If I say 2 years, no one will believe me. So let's make it 5.
Yeah.
This is some kind of gray area where, you know, I think 5 is much too aggressive. I think 20 is a sure thing. And what teach my high school mathematics teacher needs, if progress is steady, then, or if there is a steady line between 2 points, then between 2 points, there needs to be like you hit the point, every point in between. So I think if 5 is too early and 20 is too late, then it's somewhere in between, but it's not beyond 20. It's not below 5. So I think that's what I think.
Yeah. Come back to my earlier point around all the apps are going to be eaten up by the app. The need for all these separate applications and services, I do see it being replaced by by models that can do everything and we just have to fine tune them. I see a massive shift in that direction. And I think it feels unthinkable now because, you know, my B2B SaaS app, we do this very specific niche thing and, you know, and the other enterprise apps are like, no, but we have a very complicated financial system. And I understand all of that. But I think in the broad sense, I think we're going to go from programming to teaching. How do I teach this model? How do I fine tune the model? How do I know how to work with data? And Elon Musk talked about Twitter moving towards the everything app, you know, X.
Yeah.
And again, I think this is another testament to just, he is one of us. He is thinking forward. And if you love or hate the guy, there is this move towards, I just think apps are going to go away. I really can't see how people hate passwords. People hate account creation. People hate remembering which app they did what in. People have a common needs. And so if the response from the software development community certainly cannot be more programming, it has to be more training, more models, more learning, more teaching.
Minor point. I think is it Albert Einstein there in the background?
My hero.
Yes. He was born in the city I studied at university. You know, he was born in Ulm. And that's so it's funny because he's talking in this local dialect. So if you talk in English and you listen to him in English, he still has this local, I hear it, this local dialect from that very pronounced dialect, Schwäbisch.
Schwäbisch. Oh, yeah. Interesting. Is that what means? Schwäbischer, I've seen that word around Germany.
Yeah. The area is essentially Schwaben.
Schwaben.
Schwäbisch.
I thought that was a sausage. Schwäbische.
I think there's a sausage for everything in Germany, isn't there? Like everyone has some kind of sausage. I have another topic.
Please.
Is your boss such a tyrant you need a job quitting agent? And that's an article from The Register, which some years ago, 10 years ago, was a huge thing. And today, like sometimes whenever I come over a link from The Register, I think, oh, it's still there. And it's about Japan and how in Japan you have job quitting agencies and agents where you don't go to your to your boss because you fear the boss or the humiliation it's not easy to quit a job, so you go to an agent. And I thought, it's probably pronounced Taishoku Daiko or something like that. And what I thought is like this sometimes would be useful for CTOs. And I wondered if I should, as a CTO coach, should offer that service. You know, sometimes people, they don't want to quit their job. Perhaps I should do it for them, I thought, like as a service. But in general, the point would be that people stay too long. Sometimes people stay too long in their job. They suffer and stay.
Career coaching is so important, man. Man, it is so, so important. I mean, you have one life to live. You have one career arc. Some people manage changing careers completely. But boy, I mean, you don't want to learn some important information when you turn 50.
No.
From this article, this is big in Japan. So I'll just read the few paragraphs. Certain tech bosses are notoriously temperamental, so may this not be you, whoever is listening. So much so that conflict-averse folks, which we all know our developers are mostly conflict-averse, have been known to put in their notice while the execs are on leave. But some Japanese employees have taken this a step further, actually employing an agent to quit their job for them. The idea is to extricate themselves from delicate scenarios where they feel bullied to stay on board or are otherwise unwilling to leave for fear of being accused of betraying the corporation. Wow. And I know, in our world, in sort of the Western world, where it's about your job history, it's about your references, it's about your ultimately your reputation, these could all have a negative effect on you and cause you to stay at a job longer than you should.
Yeah. But I mostly see this in managers, actually. I think developers see this sometimes in developers, but developers have a kind of healthy appetite for new jobs, new thingies, new shiny thingies, and new jobs bring new shiny thingies, and old jobs don't. So it happens. I think developers have too often a healthy appetite for a new job. Like that was something that if you're a CTO, you always dread that that message we say, Stefan, can we talk? You know, whenever someone says, Stefan, can we talk? I know. Okay. I know what the person wants to talk about. So, but I think the managers, because they have some kind of loyalty for the, which is a good thing, but they have a loyalty for the employees and for the company. And sometimes I think managers, tech managers are not quitting enough, I think.
A question that I often think about, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is when do you need to be staying at a company, and when should you be leaving? So when is the resistance that you're experiencing good for you and contributing to your experience? But when is it just destructive and it's really you're just wasting time? And I think of this particularly with CTOs sometimes. You know, when is it time for you to just quit the job because you're just going to get nowhere? The resistance you get month in and month out is causing more harm than good. But when is it that resistance is actually training a brand new set of skills for yourself? I wonder about that.
I mostly changed jobs when I had the feeling that I could not grow anymore. Like when I kind of point, seen it all, done it all, at least on big topics. Like there is always change, there's always something new. But on the bigger topics, when I had the feeling that I could not grow anymore, mostly that was the point when I looked for something else. I once met a manager at eBay. She was working for another company and then moved to eBay. And her reason to change job was that she was there for quite some time in the company, and then there were always new people. And then her standard response to everything was, we did that already, it didn't work. We tried that already, you know? So every new idea that was brought forward in that company, her response was, we did that already. We have done that, you know? And she realized that that's not healthy and that's not productive and that's not helpful for anyone. You know, when she self-reflected about this, and that was her reason to change job. And it's a little bit the same where...
Will you have the awareness to know that you cannot grow here anymore? Isn't that part of the growth, is that you... You know, I worry about the awareness that you have in a difficult situation to even know if you have the tooling or the awareness to even know if you're done growing at that place or not.
I think it's, for me, it's if when things get too easy, you know, they are still difficult, but they are not threatening anymore. You know, like if things become routine and challenges become routine, and when things are not, for me, when things are not threatening anymore, when things are threatening, I know I'm kind of I'm out of my comfort zone. You know, things are threatening. I think about this. I think, well, what to do there? What to do here? I take, which is not healthy probably, but I take problems with me home. And if this stops, if I don't feel threatened by, which is a strange thing to say, but if I'm no longer threatened by stuff that happens, so not threatened like meeting a lion, but like a little bit feeling a little bit threatened. And if that this goes away, someone could say, okay, if the kick goes away, but I think that's not it. It's the if this goes away, I think it's kind of becomes too easy dealing with difficult situations, and that would be the point where I think I've outgrown the role in this particular company.
Yes. My brain is wanting to create a little framework. If these three things, then boom, you should bounce. I mean, unfortunately, I have seen, you know, in the 12 years I've been doing 7 CTOs, I have seen people stay at jobs for too long.
Last one, there was this GitHub a project which is called GPT Migrate, and it's about automatically migrating code to another language and framework with ChatGPT. I think what was remarkable about that one, I haven't tried it. I will try it, but I haven't tried it yet. But what was remarkable is that it also it migrates the code. It looks for source dependencies. It tries to replace it with relevant stuff in a new target. And then it creates unit tests. It also creates unit tests to test the code that it migrated and see if it still works and leads to the same returns if you have an API endpoint. And then it says it reads the logs to find the errors and debug the code from reading the logs. And that was something like, I thought, that's 2 years early. I thought, I'm not sure it works, but to me, it felt 2 years early, you know. Probably not a lot to discuss here, but I think this is, I would try that.
I think reading logs and so it runs the code.
Yeah. It migrates, it runs the old code, I think. Then it runs a new, migrates, it runs a new code, and it looks into the logs if they are error free. And tries to debug problems and change code based on errors in the logs. At least that's what it says on the GitHub page, as I said. I haven't tried it.
Yeah, I think the... I wonder if this could be a magnificent training tool for... You know, my first thought goes to people who have started their app in one tech stack and subsequently realized that that was the wrong choice.
Haskell.
One of my close friends is a Haskell freak. In my mind, I'm seeing all this amazing opportunity for learning, exploring. And then in a perfect scenario, not being locked into whatever bad choices you made in the past. But that part feels almost unreal to me that you could, you know, can I take my Ruby on Rails web app and just run this thing and it'll become a Django app? Kind of crazy.
If this works, it's kind of crazy, yes. And I have this, my first thought, it fuzzies the programming language kind of, like not fuzzy in the kind of fuzzing. But in a way, it blurs the programming language. So, you know, you get up in the morning as a CTO, come into work and ask, on what stack are we running today? You know, it's like, it's just like this kind of sci-fi Heisenberg, like the programming language becomes some kind of Heisenberg thing where it changes. When you look at it, it changes. It can't be defined in what stack it's currently running. You know, and perhaps some servers are running on that stack and some servers are running on that stack. And it kind of blurs the concept of a programming language, I think. I'm sure it's not working as advertised, that would be. But we'll see. But, you know, That was my first thought. What programming stack are we running today?
I think what would be helpful is just to say how it works. So it migrates from source language to target language. GPT Migrate first creates a Docker environment for the target language. It evaluates your existing code recursively to identify, like you said, this third parties. Actually, you said all of this already. So, this is crazy.
And writes unit tests and debugs from the logs. That's 2 years.
I mean, if anything, the language models are just showing us how trivial coding has become.
Yeah. And I think, can you go to this Bill Gates article?
Okay.
There was some amazing thing in it. Like he had two moments and he had one special moment, which was when he was shown the a graphical user interface first time, and he thought, oh, well, that's opening a new whole world of things. And he had the same feeling when he was at OpenAI and they showed him AI stuff. He had the same feeling like with GUI. Interestingly, he didn't say the same thing about the internet. Like I would say, my point would be programming, first time programming, second, going to the internet. Third time looking at ChatGPT, that would be my mind-blown moments. He didn't use internet. He used the graphical user interface, which made him rich. So, but oof, yeah, who cares? But there was a point later on, I think he wrote something about where they asked the AI to write a note or something. So they gave the AI a AP bio exam, which it excelled at. We asked it a non-scientific questions. What do you say to a father with a sick child? It wrote a thoughtful answer that was probably better than most of us in the room would have given. The whole experience was stunning.
Wow.
I thought that one is, wow.
Yeah, I continue to see the elevation of the human species by just having, instead of having a blank sheet of paper, you have ideas to begin with. Like you are sourcing. The source material is given to us now.
Yeah. Yeah. We can think about the things and the ideas, not the tools, perhaps.
Yes. Yeah. And I know my default mode to this day is still not to go to ChatGPT. I have to keep reminding myself, oh, hang on, I should probably first go and see, is my source material, like what should I be looking at? What should I be thinking about? And then I draw incredible inspiration sometimes from, even if I read something that's like, ugh, okay, the GPT said we should have empathy for our employee. Okay, great. But then my neural net is close enough to another node that fires off and it's like, oh, well, this reminds me of the time that I did. And then that sparks off a whole new set of thoughts. I think that's incredible.
Yes.
And I'm relieved that Bill Gates thinks that AI is amazing.
But on the same level, like, I think it's at the point for me that on the same level, like the internet, I think that's, a lot of people think that way, but I don't think enough people will think that way, that probably AI will dwarf the internet. It's just as internet kind of dwarfed the arrival of the PC somehow, in some ways, not in all ways, but in some ways. I think AI will dwarf the arrival of the internet. And that's, I think that magnitude is not yet there, which I think the article points out.
Yeah, you know, this makes me think of Databricks's acquisition of Mosaic ML, $1.3 billion. Mosaic ML, I think, is an open AI competitor. But can you imagine a world where you can just tell, like if you think about data lakes, where you could just ask in plain English, who are my top three customers, and just tell me about them. Like, what was their usage pattern of
why
our
are
app?
Why are they my top customers?
I mean, it's like we have all this data. You know, it's like you have a library, right? I have bookshelves. I have the bookshelves and I have the books on there. But that data is inaccessible to me unless I get up, go to pick a random book, open a random page, and read it. And that's a lot of CTOs, that's what they have, is they have incredible, pristine log files and amazing usage data and analytics and telemetry. But the thought that they have, oh, I wonder if this feature had any impact on our MRR, or was it maybe a red herring and it was actually because we hired a new sales guy. You know, was it the sales guy? Was it the feature? That data is yes. in your it's, building. Yes. It's there. Yes. You just don't know how to get it.
Yeah. I call that the law of Etienne. That I think that you said, we discussed why is an AI writing better tests? And your point was, I think that the difference is that the AI knows all the code. Knows all usages, all paths, all the code. It has a totally holistic view of the universe of your code. And that is that creates a different quality in understanding things. You know, you only, as a developer, you only know, I don't know, 5% or 10% of your code, depending on the code size, you know. And if a large company, it's 1% you have in your head, and 99%, it's just gray. But the AI has a holistic understanding of all of your code. And this leads to a quality-wise, a result on a different level. It's just not a little bit better. It's a magnitude better. It's a different quality of result, you know? This is kind of, I think, the law of Etienne, that the holistic knowledge of everything leads to an order of magnitude different results. And it's just, I think it's the same with your library example, and as again, it's the same with the data lake example.
Yeah. I mean, the human brain. I don't care if you're an amazing A-team group of developers who can read each other's minds. You know, that will never, ever, 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 ever compete with what a very naively trained AI model can do. Or knows, I should say.
Yes, no.
So, good stuff.
Very good stuff.
Wow, we really went for it.
Yes, I enjoyed it a lot.
When was the last time you had currywurst with pommes?
That's good. I'm a vegetarian, first of all.
Okay. There you have it, another episode of the CTO Podcast. If you like the show, let us know. Like and subscribe on YouTube and subscribe to us in your favorite podcast app. It'll be amazing to keep this community growing. If you want to talk to us, we're on Telegram. Go check out CTO Podcast on our Telegram group. And of course, you can always hit us up on Twitter. I am ETDEBRUIN. And Stefan is King of Coders, KINGOFCODERS. Please head over to 7CTOs.com. Check out the most favoritist, amazingest community of CTOs on the internet and in the world. And also go check out AmazingCTO.com and subscribe to the newsletter. This is what makes the show possible, is all the amazing research and work that Stefan does to make this show happen. We love all of you, and please, let's see you next week. Cheers.